Okay, good morning everyone. Welcome to week 6 of Foundational Principles. Today's session is called Beyond Words. Just before we start, I just want to give the schedule for the next few weeks. So we've got one more week in the series, which is next week, because there's 7 chapters in the book and we're going to do the 7th and last chapter next week. After that, there's going to be 2 more weeks this term. I'm going to do a mini series. I'll tell you the topic next week. Just a 2-week series. Also, while we're talking about the schedule, in 2 weeks from now, that means the first of the 2 weeks, the first of the last 2 weeks, we'll also draw the raffle. So there are 2 weeks left to that raffle. And we're going to continue to go on Zoom for the time being, and we'll see what happens later on. We'll review, but till the end of the term, we're going to do it this way. All right, so we, in the middle of the series, Foundational Principles, we are basing ourselves on the book called The Witness by Ariel Berger, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. Just a couple of minutes of review from last week. So last week was entitled Activism. We talked about activism on a very big and global level. Like Elie Wiesel himself, who took his experiences and became a world leader, a world activist. But then we talked about the importance of everyone seeing that as something which they can apply to themselves and recognizing activism is for every person in their own small environment, recognizing the evil that's amongst us, identifying hatred. We talked about the concept of sinat chinam, baseless hatred, which we explained basically that means all negative hatred because it's always because of insecurity, it's because of the lack of ability to make space for others and so on. The rationalization always comes later. And we explained that what that means to all of us is just to develop, first of all, to recognize what it is, to develop the ability of noticing the child in need, becoming an advocate for someone who's being bullied, the friend who's just down and needs someone to reach out to them, one person at a time. That's the activism we talked about last week. We talked about the story that Elie Wiesel told about the Jewish leader that asked someone who was coming to apply, how could you notice on the way? And if you didn't notice the homeless person, the downtrodden person, and so on, he said, how can you be a leader if you don't notice those around you? So, as he says, you just need to touch one person every day with compassion. Now, before we go into today's topic, I just want to share with you one thought connected to last week. Just one thought highlighting the incredible power and the importance of touching one individual. And just, I know we said it many times, but just to highlight and to stress, to emphasize that mindset, that attitude of looking at every individual as an entire universe, as an entire world. And therefore helping one person is like helping an entire world. Saving one person is like an entire world, right? So I've shared the story with you before, this biblical story, but just today with a bit of a different twist. So there's a famous story in the Chumash with Joseph, Yosef, as you might have told, one of my favorite characters as a personal growth model, right? So Yosef is sold down to Egypt by his brothers, young boy, 17 years old, lands up without any communication with his family in Egypt, far away from his family, working in the house of Potiphar, a very high up, powerful individual. And there's that very bizarre story that he gets thrown into jail for the following reason, because the wife of Potiphar tries to seduce him. But if you look in the Psukim, it's quite obvious that she tried a number of times. If you look in the Midrashic interpretations of the verses, you'll see that she tried very, very hard with all different types of methods, every day, day after day, until the Pasuk tells us that one day, it was a public holiday of some sort, some pagan worship holiday, where most people were in their houses of worship. He didn't go. He came to the house of Potiphar to finish up some admin stuff, la'asot melachto, to do his work, or as some in commentaries explain, to do the work of acquiescing to Potiphar's wife. He almost succumbed. And she was there. She didn't go, and she thought this is her opportunity. She tried to seduce him a good way. She threatened him. At the end, Vayema'en, says the Pasuk, he refused. He absolutely refused. So the Talmud tells us what was the secret of Joseph's refusal. So we have a famous thing, and I've shared with you before, although today I'm going to give a bit of a different interpretation. It says, Dmut diokno shel aviv niralo. As he was about to succumb, as he was about to transgress, the image of his father appeared to him in the window. And he held back, and he refused. What was it about the image of his father that made him refuse? And as a result, by the way, he got thrown into jail. Because she concocted a whole story to her husband, how he was trying to do the act, and it was his fault. And anyway, he got thrown into jail and he languished in jail for a long time. So we have to understand the context of the story, right? The context of the story is you got a single guy, a young boy, away from his family, completely isolated, nothing going for him, everything is going bad, and a tremendous amount of pressure being put on him. So, in truth, naturally, it would be quite understandable if he would succumb. It would be quite normal for him to give in. He's got nothing to lose, no family image to uphold. He hasn't had a family, they're far away, he's lost communication with them. A lot of pressure, he's got no social group. The tremendous pressure that's been put upon him. She promises him the world. People give in, people lose control for much, much lesser degrees of pleasure. And so what would have held him back? What was the power? What was the power that he ultimately was able to have that incredible self-control and to refuse and to risk his life, which he in fact did? So the Talmud says the image of his father. What was about the image of his father? So there's many interpretations, but this is an interesting one. Talmud tells us, and it's brought down in Kabbalah as well, that Shufrei de Yaakov, the beauty of Jacob, was similar to the beauty of Adam. In other words, there's a lot of physical and spiritual resemblances and similarities between the first man, Adam, who was designed by God himself, and Yaakov. Adam was the father of humanity. Yaakov was the father of the Jewish people. On many levels they're connected. Their souls are connected and so on and so forth. Yaakov represented Adam, the first man. So the commentaries explain that when Joseph saw the image of Adam in the window, he didn't only see his father, he saw who his father represents. He saw Adam. And when he saw Adam, he remembered Adam HaRishon. He remembered Adam. What do you remember about Adam? That Adam was created alone. Adam was one individual. And he was one individual that was given one mitzvah to have self-control for 3 hours and not to partake of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. One individual gave in. One individual did something of a weakness. He did something wrong. And altered the history of entire human race. If you explore the story, what the world looked like before Adam sinned, what the world was going to look like, and how the world turned out to be as a result of the first sin, the first weakness, the first losing control of Adam HaRishon, one person, he happened to be half the population at that time. But nevertheless, it's one person. And in fact, the Talmud tells us, that the reason that Adam was created as an individual, the reason Adam was created a yachid, even without a partner, the partner came later, is to teach us that every single individual is a whole universe. So Yosef sees Diukno, he sees the image of his father, he looks at his father and he sees Adam. And he remembers that one person, the actions of one person alter the entire world. The action of one person affects the entire universe. In a bad way, how much more so in a good way? Because after all, don't forget, we've said this many times, the Talmud tells us that whatever happens in the negative is more powerful than the positive. So therefore, he sees Adam HaRishon did one thing and he affected the whole world negatively. How much more so? Can you imagine if Adam would have held back and had self-control, how he would have affected all of the world and humanity positively? Suddenly Yosef realizes, I'm not just a young boy. I'm not just a young person, I'm not just a young lad languishing in isolation, detached, distant from my family. That doesn't matter and I make no difference, I make the world of difference. I'm one individual, I'm an entire world. And he holds back, gathers together his strength, and he refuses. Just, I'm sharing this with you because I just learned this recently, and I'm sharing with you because it's connected to what we said last week. We don't have to change the world. We have to change one person. We have to affect one person. And we have to really believe that when we affect one person, we're affecting an entire world. Okay. Let's go to today's topic. Today's topic is the chapter Beyond Words. I have to say it was a little bit of a difficult chapter to read, actually. It's all over the place a little bit, just from a reading point of view. But the common theme in this chapter is that it deals with different forms of expression other than language. And it begins with the idea of song. So I'm going to use song as a tool, sort of the topic, the theme to go into what we want to express. And I'm going to use that and elaborate and build on that in terms of an important concept, building an important idea, which is connected to a very critical component of the human experience and how that impacts our own personal development and our own personal growth. So what I want to do is I want to just spend a few minutes reading the first part of the chapter with you, and then we're going to unpack it a little bit. So the author writes the following. He says, on a cold December morning in Boston, Professor Wiesel is singing to his students. He's singing a song from his childhood, conveying the beauty of a lost world. The song has no words. It's called a nigun, which many of you are familiar with, a wordless melody, and it gives me the chills. Then he continues, he says his eyes are closed, and he sways with the rhythm of the melody. His hands move gently up and down as he's conducting an invisible choir. He ends the melody and waits for a moment in silence before opening his eyes. He says, this nigun of the Vizhnitsa Hasidim, which was Elie Wiesel's origin, is the best way I know to return to my childhood and to share it with you. Later, the author writes the following. He says, after class, he went to Elie Wiesel's office and he said to him, Professor, can I ask you a question? Of course, says Elie Wiesel. He says, I'm curious, why did you decide to sing today? You've never done that before, at least not while I've been your teacher's assistant. It was beautiful and moving, but why today? He looks at me soberly and says, sometimes we must move beyond words. As you know, teaching and learning do not happen only through the sharing of information. There must be an added element. I have been lecturing all semester. The students have been reading wonderful novels and plays we have questioned and discussed. And yet I feel something was missing, the melody. So I decided to sing. Then the author continues and he says, I thought about this brief conversation over the next few weeks. Now that he mentioned it, I could see that the groups of students seemed less engaged than others in previous years. It was subtle, but it was so. The moment of song opened some hidden door, and in the class meeting that followed, the discussions were more alive. Now, that's a beautiful description. By the way, if you've ever seen a video of Elie Wiesel singing, there are a few. It's a very good description of him singing, actually. But later he explains this a bit and explains what Elie Wiesel says in the classroom. And let me just read you one more piece. He says, Professor Wiesel considered memory to be an essential ingredient in educating people towards humanity, right? Which is what he did. I mean, we discussed it the very first week. So memory, the information, history, and real memory, which was reliving the history, was used then to share it with others and to fight for humanity as he did, fighting for tolerance and love and to ensure that what happened in the Holocaust should never happen again. But he also acknowledged the limits of transmitting memories. So he says, what do you do when you approach those limits? What do you do as a writer and as a teacher when words fail? And he writes that in terms of Elie Wiesel, he was torn between the need to share his Holocaust testimony with the world and the impossibility of doing so. Because words are limiting, right? So he said, because words alone cannot convey the experience. And he ends off that piece and he says, look, said Elie Wiesel, language is essential. It is more than a vehicle to transmit ideas or memories. It is a desire of the human being to transcend his own limits. Language is composed of words, but is more than words. It is also the white spaces between the letters, the words, the people. is a very, very powerful line. So I want to unpack this a little bit and explore this whole concept and then sort of share with you what I think it means for us as people and as people who want to grow and improve and inspire ourselves and inspire others. So let's just start with this. Let's just revisit the power of words, first of all, right? We've spoken about this many times, but let's revisit briefly the power of words. We know that communication is very powerful. Words are very powerful. We've mentioned many times that a human being is called a midaber. That's the description given by the Talmud to describe the human being. There are four parts of the world: the inanimate, the growing things like trees and plants, the animal kingdom, and the human being. But the human being is defined as the midaber, the speaker, the one who uses words. We've talked about many times at the very beginning of Bereshit in Genesis, where God blows in the neshama, he blows the soul into the nostrils of man, a piece of himself. It says there, Vayihi Adam lenefesh chaya, the man became a living soul, which the Targum, the ancient Aramaic divinely inspired translation, translates as the man became Ruach Memalala, a speaking spirit. Words we know give us the ability to connect, to go beyond ourselves, to create relationships. The only way that we can go beyond our own world and connect to the world of another is through words, through communication, all true. We also know the power of words. Now you'll remember, some of you will remember, I'm sure, the analogy we've given often from Kabbalah about languages, about words, that words are compared to sus verachvo, the rider and the horse. In which way? Because words are nothing, right? Words are only as good as the content you put into the words. So words are like the horse driven by the driver. So we have words and we do with them what we want. We put in whichever words, whichever content we want to put into the words. I can say words that mean nothing, or I can say words that hopefully mean something. I can say words that are stupid. I can say words that hopefully are intelligent. Depending on the content, they're the same letters, the same words, but depending on the content I put into them, depending how I steer the words. So therefore, the person, the content is like the driver, the words are like the horse. Yet, we know that the horse can take the driver to places and with speed that the driver cannot achieve on their own. So therefore, the power of words is, although I direct the content of my words, but when I put them into words, it takes me to a place I cannot go myself. If it's intellectual stuff, it gives me clarity that I cannot achieve without words. If it's emotion, it fuels the emotion more in greater ways, in deeper ways than I can do myself, negatively and positively. That's why if you want to diffuse a bad emotion, you keep quiet. If you want to enhance love and good emotion, you speak about it. You verbalize it, because that's the power of words. Just like the horse can take someone to a destination quicker and further than the rider can. If it's a good destination, he gets there quicker. If it's a bad destination, they're getting lost, he gets lost quicker. So that's all part of the amazing power of words. At the end of the day, it is words and words alone, which are the tool of education, the tool of activism, the tool of expression of values, the tool to express ideas, and can be done in a very deep way. And words give us the ability to be able to convey these things in an incredibly powerful and deep way. So we know the power of words. I just wanted to revisit it for a few seconds just so we refresh our memories. The power of words are amazing. But as they say in Hebrew, sof kol sof, at the end of the day, words alone are limiting. And let's understand why. I'm just going to share with you from a Kabbalistic point of view and what we are explained in the ancient Jewish sources of why words are limiting. They're limiting for many reasons, but one of the reasons they're limiting is because at the end of the day, as much as words express, as much as words allow me to connect, words also conceal, right? Because words, at the end of the day, communicate a tremendous amount about myself, but they don't communicate the full depth of myself. The person themselves doesn't connect. Good language does a little bit of that, but at the end of the day, it's not the depth of me. You see, this is just to illustrate this. This is the difference between what they call machshava and dibur, thought and speech. If I have an amazing moment of clarity, I have an incredible thought, it's so powerful. I've encapsulated an idea, I've encapsulated a feeling, a conviction, a belief, and I have that flash of thought. It will take me essays to communicate it to you. It'll take me lots of sentences. And the way the process of speech goes, that I cannot take the intensity of thought and share it with you. I have to break it down into words, into sentences. Each word, each sentence, each paragraph sort of dilutes and holds back some of what's behind the design of that composition. So something gets lost in the speech. A good essay, if you put all the sentences together, after a while, the picture becomes clear. You paint a picture, but you're painting a picture through steps of concealment, through steps of dilution. It is not the same as the intensity of me, myself. It is, at the end of the day, it's how I relate to something outside of myself. So something of me, the essence of me, the real me, gets lost or diluted in the speech, even as powerful as it is. Yes, it's the only way I could connect to you. It's the only way I could connect to the outside world. But it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of losing part of me because I'm connecting to something else. I'll give you just a spiritual idea that sort of makes it a bit more clearer. The Kabbalists tell us, we know that God created the world with speech, right? That's the metaphor. God said, let there be light. God said, let there be plants, let there be people, let there be fish, and so on. And then he stopped creating on Shabbat. So what does that mean? It doesn't create anymore? How does the world exist? We know the concept that the God continuously recreates the universe. So how did the world exist on Shabbat? The answer is, of course he creates on Shabbat. But at a different level, what does that mean? It means that during the week, we are taught that the world is at the level of speech. On Shabbat, the world is elevated to the level of machshava, the level of thought. What does that mean? During the week, God creates a world which he relates to as an other. That's why it's through speech. There's him, and he's relating to something else outside of him, so to speak. Which is why, although we can learn, and although we can understand, although we can look at God's words that he used to create the world, and the words of the Torah, and the words that he communicates with us, at the end of the day, he remains hidden in this world. At the end of the day, God is not obvious in the creation. We have to learn about it. We have to think about it. And we still don't get the complete bond with him because God, by design, created a world through speech. What does it mean through speech? He created a universe where he somewhat is diluted, where he somewhat is hidden. You don't get the full him, and that's why he's not obvious during the weekday. What's Shabbat? Now, Shabbat doesn't do it for all of us in terms of seeing what we could see on Shabbat. But Shabbat, we are taught the world is different. The world is elevated. It's elevated to a level of speech. What does that mean? It's elevated to a level of connection with God, which still means we have to work at it. But on Shabbat, that means it becomes easier to notice God and godliness. It becomes easier to notice holiness because the relationship between the world and God on Shabbat is one of thought. My thought is also a means of expression, but it's connected with me. You cannot differentiate between me and my thought. Speech, I separate. I can speak and then I stop speaking. It might be recorded. You might listen to it tomorrow, but I'm gone. So speech and me are somewhat detached. My thought and me, if I'm not here, my thought isn't here. Even though my thought theoretically is something separate. So God on Shabbat continues to create the world, but at a different level. He creates the world in his thought, not in his speech. When you create something in your thought, if you think about, if you build a house, the house is separate from you. If you think about the house is created in your thought, but it's one thing with you. It's not a physical detached house. So the world on Shabbat is connected to God in a deeper way than during the week, which is why that's what it means he stops creating. That on Shabbat, it goes back to its essence, it goes back to becoming one with him, it goes back to its original source because there's not that separation. And that's why Shabbat is a time of being, is a time of connection, it's time to connect to God in a more obvious way because the difference between speech and machshava. I'm just bringing that in because we need to understand that with all the power of words are unbelievable, but the power of words are still limiting. Therefore, with all the benefit of language and words, there are times that whether we're expressing something to ourselves, or we're trying to reveal something within ourselves, or we're trying to reveal something to other people, we're trying to inspire a part of ourselves to other people, we're trying to share a conviction, something deep, something that becomes impossible to express in words, there comes a time where we have to look deeper than words. And we have to somehow share something which transcends language. And there are many, many ways of doing that. But for a couple of moments, I'm just going to share and talk about what he talks about, the idea of a song, the idea of a nigun. Right? You know, my background is Hasidic family, right? So in Hasidic practice, there's a tremendous, tremendous emphasis on nigun. Huge importance placed on the concept of singing a nigun. And where I come from, the greatest nigunim, the greatest songs are songs without words. Some of you have heard me sing them before and so on. But why? Because we are taught that the nigun, the song, is the pen, the quill of the heart. In other words, a song can transport you, a song can communicate, a song can express and go places where words cannot. We, you know, I think back and I try to do this every so often myself, but I look back at the time of yeshiva where we'd sit down at a deep fabrengen where the mentor, the spiritual guide, would talk and he would express something. And then we would say a little bit of l'chaim and then we'd try and internalize it. We try and internalize it, and there was always a nigun between each section. Now, what was the purpose of the nigun? Why do we sing a nigun between each segment of talking? Because very often the content that was being communicated to us was something that we had to touch a deeper level. We had to internalize something a bit beyond the words. It was expressed the best as best as he possibly could through words, but then he would say, let's sing a nigun. Let's try and internalize this with a nigun. And sometimes we break into one of these really deep, slow, heart-moving songs that don't have words, because then with their own words, each person could connect to it the way they could connect to it, and each person was able to go deeper into it. And if you ask, what do we think about during the song, it's hard to put into words, because when you sing a real deep nigun, you go beyond words. And that's how the depth of the topic, or the hidden part of the topic, or the part of the topic that could not be conveyed through words, somehow was communicated. Because a song can take you a place where words cannot take you. There's a book called Likutei Diburim. And over there, there's a very beautiful description, just to give you a little bit of flavor what this means. Because emunah, you know, we spoke about a few weeks ago, the concept of conviction, faith, that's often also not transmitted through words. You can talk about it. You can talk about the importance of it. You can talk about the necessity of having it. But at the end of the day, it doesn't always come through words. So there's a beautiful description of a story of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev. Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev was a tremendous tzaddik. He lived about 300 years ago. And there's a story told about one time he gathered his talmidim, he gathered his disciples. And he said, we're taking a trip. And he comes to a shtetl. And in that shtetl, they live there, a notorious poritz. For those who know what a poritz is, like a feudal lord. That the entire shtetl, particularly the Jewish community of the shtetl, were in complete trepidation. They were frightened of him beyond. It turns out that this feudal lord, this poritz, was actually once a Jew who had converted. He had renounced his faith in God. And he'd become an anti-Semite and a tyrant. And he had these very famous, in that city, or infamous, two huge black dogs. And everyone knew that this, you don't do anything, they were eggshells, you don't do anything to upset this guy. And you certainly, if he goes for a walk and his dogs are around, you don't do anything to upset him or his dogs, because you finish. This is where the story is described, the story is told. And the Berditchev Rav comes with his Talmidim, he comes with his disciples to that town, and it's towards the end of the day. And he says, you know, it's time to daven Ma'ariv. It's time to say the evening prayers, which include the Shema and the Amidah and so on. And he turned around and there's a minyan. You know, he's got a lot of Talmidim. He's got a lot of disciples, Hasidim, with him. And there's a minyan. And he says, I'd like to just gather somewhere and pray the evening service. And he says, what I'd like to do is, I'd like to go to where that poritz lives. And everyone freezes. And the people of the shtetl of town says, Rabbi, you don't go there. You won't come out alive. He says, don't worry about me. And he goes into that, he opens the gates and the dogs come out and they freeze. We are taught part of the story. And he just, with his Talmidim, with tremendous pride, he strides through and he comes into the place where the poritz is, and the poritz sees him and he starts to get into a rage. He starts to get angry and suddenly he sees the beauty of the tzaddik, he sees the beauty of this Berditchev Rav, and he too calms down and he just sort of freezes, he's unable to speak. And the Baditchev Rav, the Levi Yitzchak Baditchev, the well-renowned tzaddik, he turns around to his Talmidim and he says, let's start the evening prayers. And before he starts the evening prayers, he says he wants to sing a nigun. And the nigun has two parts. The first part of the nigun, and they relate to the first two sentences of the evening prayer. That's why it's got to do with the evening prayer. And the first part of the nigun, he says, describes the difficulty and the challenge of the soul coming down to the body. With a bit of an introduction, he says the soul comes from a pristine place. The soul comes from God Himself, the throne of glory. But there comes a time where God wants to send the soul down to the body so that the person could live and go through the challenges of living in this world, but overcome the challenges and serve God in this world of struggle, in this world of challenge. And the soul doesn't want to come down. And it's a journey the soul has to travel down, has to be forced into the body. That's part one. And part two is when the soul eventually realizes that overcoming the struggles in this world, overcoming failure, rebouncing back after you've slipped, overcoming temptation, developing self-control, revealing the inner faith that's deep-rooted within the soul is all worth it, makes it all worth it, because the soul becomes elevated. The soul that comes from this pristine, pure place can only reach true heights and true connection with God by coming to this world. And he says it to them, and he says, let's describe this process. And he starts to sing the nigun, and the nigun has two parts. Part one depicts struggle, confusion, darkness, a journey of the soul, but without words. And it conveys it deeper than words could express. It takes the person into the world of the soul struggle a lot deeper than words could ever do. And then he changes course. He goes to part two of the nigun, describing the soul's strength, the soul's resilience, the soul's faith, and the bouncing back and the confidence that it can get through the struggle and connect to God in the most deepest way. Again, expressing it in a way that words cannot do. Taking the listener of the song to the place, to the connection to the soul that no one could ever do, no one could ever take you there with words. And as he finishes the song, the poet is crying bitterly. To cut a long story short, this was the moment that the Baditchev Rebbe was able to save the neshama of the Poritz, to bring back his Jewishness. The Poritz leaves the town, goes back to his ways, becomes Jewish again, and lives his rest of his life serving God. Why do I tell you that story? Because as I was preparing this, I remember that story. And I went to look it up again, and I remember the story because it brings out the point that this could only be done. This person was so lost. This person had sunken so low, words would never retrieve him. It needed a nigun. Why? Not because it needed song or music. It needed something deeper than words. It needed a conviction to be shared, a faith to be communicated and conveyed that could only be done through something that is deep-rooted, soulful, and that is much deeper than words. And that's what Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Baditchev was able to do. We do this every year. You know when? In a different way. That's the depth. I know we're still way behind, a way to go for this, but we do this every year on Rosh Hashanah. And we blow the shofar. That's the whole point of the shofar. The point of the shofar is that when we come to Rosh Hashanah, we start a new year. And we want to reconnect to God on the most deepest level. Which most often is through prayer, through Torah learning, through words. Which is very powerful. And we have to bring it down to the world of words. Otherwise we don't understand and we don't explain and we don't internalize. But at the very deepest level, it's done not through words. The first point of the new year, every single year, is done through shofar, because shofar is a cry that comes from the deepest level of the soul that cannot be expressed verbally, that cannot be expressed through words. That's the power of going deeper than words, which we have to do sometimes. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in one of his articles, calls this the sound of silence. He very, very beautiful. He says, it's actually an article which I read a few weeks ago talking about Shavuot, why the Torah was given in a desert. And he said one of the reasons is because a desert is a silent place. And when the Torah was given and the connection between the Jewish people and God took place, it needed to be done in a desert, because he says there's a spiritual reason for this. The desert is a place of silence. There's nothing visually to distract you, and there's no ambient noise to muffle sound. There was thunder and lightning when the Torah was given, but then the world went completely still. Because the silence of the desert was that silence which is beyond words. Sometimes silence is bad, but sometimes silence is going deeper than words. So that sound of silence is tapping into what's beyond the words, what's between the letters, what Elie Wiesel calls the white space between the letters, what's expressed in the way the Torah is written even, that the Torah is written in a way where every letter, I've shared this with you before, a Torah scroll or a mezuzah is written where every letter must be surrounded by blank parchment. If one letter touches another, it's invalid because every letter must stand alone. And one of the mystical reasons for that is because the space between the letters, the space around the letters is that part that's even beyond the letter, that's deeper than the letter, deeper than words. So that's the concept, and that's, I think, what Elie Wiesel was trying to express when he talked about the nigun, talked about the power of the song and how it would wake up someone in a way where words cannot. So what does it mean to us? What's this relevant to us? A nice idea. But what does it mean to us? It means to us in our everyday living, in our everyday personal development and personal growth, that we need to do this once in a while. Sometimes we need to understand that the way to connect to something in a deeper way, whether it's in ourselves or to others, we need to tap into the language of silence. We need to go to a level of expression which is beyond words. You know, there's a concept that I've used in parenting sessions, which is called voice to values. You know, one of the things that we try to teach our children, or one of the things we express and try and inspire everyone with in our circle of influence, in our role of leadership, is values, right? What's interesting is that values are very hard to teach because values are not information. Values are part of living, right? So there's a formula that's developed in psychological literature called that if you want to impart values to people, you need to give voice to values. What does that mean? So first of all, they talk about words being really important. So if you want to, you know, if you want your young child not to steal or not to tell a lie, it's no good just once in a while saying, you know, it's really bad to steal or it's really bad to tell a lie. You've got to always visit the topic and explain it. You've got to find opportunities to talk about it, to share information, to educate. Education is definitely the step one. Education is a critical component of all of this. Right? The second part, of course, sounds cliched but critically important. You've got to be a living example. But then they talk about a third component. A third component of teaching values, and apparently this is the only way that the values are successfully transmitted, is excitement, passion. In other words, it's a child seeing or another person seeing how you live this value with excitement, how it bothers you when someone doesn't live up to the value, how you get intolerant of when they see dishonesty or lack of integrity, how you get excited when you see a person who's completely honest and telling the truth and upright and good personality and refined human being and a helpful and kindness and compassion. How you, in other words, it's that language which is higher than words. Ultimately, you can never plant a value in someone else. You can never transmit a value to someone else unless together with the education, together with the words, you give over something which is higher than the words. Similar to the nigun. In this case, it's maybe excitement or passion. It's a language of silence, which is so much more powerful than words. Obviously, it's got to be translated into words because that's the only way you internalize it afterwards. That's the only way it carries with you when there's education and there's explanation and there's what we call hasbara and so on and so forth. But sometimes the crunch, the point of connection, the way you instill it is beyond words. That passion that comes with cannot be communicated. It's just you see in the person, wow, that person lives, that person gets so excited. There's a famous story. I'll tell you two stories. Two beautiful stories. There's a famous story with the Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim's name is Rabbi Yisrael Meigel Kogan. Very, very famous Jewish leader who lived in pre-war times in the city of Radin. And as a leader, there was once a terrible situation there with the Jewish people and the government wanted to do things that would affect the Jewish community and so on and so forth. And a bunch of people, under the guidance of the Chofetz Chaim, went to talk to government officials. Not very kind government officials. These were regimes that were hostile towards the Jewish community. They went, they had a meeting, they explained, they tried to give over how this would be very detrimental for the Jewish community, for the continuity, for the spiritual destiny, and so on and so forth. And they failed. They failed. They tried their best to give it over. They tried their best to convince the official, and it didn't work. and very dejected and feeling very bad, they came back to report to the Chafetz Chaim and they said, we tried, we explained, we used such good language, we communication, we tried our best and it didn't work. And the Chafetz Chaim famously turned around to the group and with piercing eyes, he said in Yiddish, and I'll translate, he said, "Hat eimitze gechalisht? Did any one of you faint when you spoke about it? Did you faint?" What he meant was, words are limiting. If it really was so important to you, and it was a matter of life and death, and it was so important to you, did someone faint? Or did someone, I guess, at least look like they were going to faint? Did you communicate the strength of what you were trying to say beyond words? He felt that it wasn't deep enough. He felt that the communication was probably unbelievably effective, but they didn't tap into the language of silence. Had someone fainted, maybe, they would have conveyed the message of how incredibly important this is. We don't need to faint, but we do need to inspire people sometimes beyond words. Sometimes we're trying to convince people, we're trying to persuade people, or better say, we're trying to inspire people to be more spiritual, to be a better person, to live with better values. Sometimes it's what comes through with the excitement, the passion, the language of silence, the conviction, the faith that is expressed deeper than words that does the trick. It could be a nigun. It could be something else, but it's something that which is deeper than words. There's another story which I think I've shared with you, but it's about one of my people who I admire. You've heard me talk about him lots of times, the Kloisenberger Rebbe. He was the one that lost a wife and 11 children in the war and then rebuilt afterwards two big Hasidic communities, one in New Jersey and one in Israel. And he started his rebuilding the day the war ended. He was in the camps, had lost everything, but the day the war ended and they were placed in DP camps, he started to rebuild. In the DP camps, he started to educate people, he started shiurim, he started to build people's hopes, people's confidence, he arranged marriages, he taught, he made a cheder, a school, all in the DP camps immediately, got onto it right away. Eventually, he rebuilt two communities, and as I've told you many times, he even built a hospital, a very, very famous hospital, a very advanced hospital in Netanya, in Israel, that operates till today. Interesting enough, nothing to do with the lecture, but his second wife, because he rebuilt a family as well. He remarried, had five children, who are leading the Hasidic dynasties today. He passed away like 20 years ago, but his wife just passed away a few weeks ago, actually. In the DP camp, there was a very angry teenager who wouldn't do anything. He didn't want to know from anything. He didn't want to talk to people. He didn't want to do anything spiritual. He didn't want to come to any lesson. He didn't want to come to any shul. He didn't want to do anything. He was angry and that was it. Rightfully so, understandably so. But there were people who knew him were worried about him. He had no family, as many people didn't have there, and they were worried about him. And they came to ask the Kloisenberger Rebbe what to do. They said, "We've tried to talk to him, nothing's worked." And the Kloisenberger Rebbe said, "Try and convince him to come and see me." And at first he's adamant, he's not seeing, he doesn't need a Rebbe, he doesn't need a Rebbe, he doesn't need anything. I said, "Just go and sit with him for a few minutes." And he came and he sat down. And the Kloisenberger Rebbe said to him nothing. He looked at him, waiting him to speak. And after a while of getting a bit more comfortable, this young teenager looks at the Rebbe angrily. And he just says to him one sentence, he says, "They took the best," referring to members of his family, obviously, who had perished in the Holocaust. And the Kloisenberger Rebbe said nothing. He took his hand, he took this boy's hand, held it, and started to cry. He started to cry, the boy started to cry. And just every few moments, the Kloisenberger Rebbe just repeated the sentence that he said, "They took the best." And somehow he broke the ice and that boy returned to his roots and he started becoming part of the community and he became afterwards a member of the Jewish community, an effective one, and he healed to the best of their ability. The Kloisenberger Rebbe told him nothing, but they communicated in a very, very deep level. They communicated through the language of silence. Somehow, the communication, without putting it into words, transmitted from the Rebbe to the boy. Later on, they spoke words when they developed a relationship. But in the beginning, it was just conviction. It was the Teuzenberg Rebbe's faith. It was his acknowledgement that he too had gone through even worse what that boy had gone through. And yet somehow he was ready to rebuild. He was ready to reconnect. He was ready to have faith. All those things, I don't know exactly, but somehow all of those things were transmitted through a language of silence, through languages beyond words. That's dramatic, but we can do that as well. We don't have to cry. We never went through those things and so on, thank God. But we can do that as well. Sometimes it's not about explaining. It's about living. Sometimes not about communicating and saying drushes and giving sermons. It's about communicating something through the language of silence, through conviction, through passion, through a nigun, through whatever medium, through a tear, whatever it is. But it's about communicating something which is much deeper than language. And it's something we all need to learn how to do. Because that's sometimes the only effective way to really express a deep relationship, to really express something deep towards another person, to really reveal a part of us which is deeper than words, and we all have that spark, to transmit it, to connect our depth with someone else's depth, our depth with God's depth. To express our depth on any level requires us to dig deeper and to delve into the language of silence. A few weeks ago, we spoke about this concept of emunah. Again, the concept of emunah, the concept of faith, is something which transcends logic. And therefore, emunah specifically is something which sometimes can only be transmitted through the language of silence. And we find this explicitly in the Torah, in the very tragic story where Aaron HaKohen, Moses' brother, Aaron the Kohen, loses his two children. Tragically, when the day that the Mishkan was inaugurated, Nadav and Avihu, which had done the wrong thing, and so on and so forth. And Aaron didn't say anything. The Torah says two very famous words, Vayidom Aharon, Aharon was silent. And that silence spoke volumes. Someone once asked me, you know, generally silence speaks volumes. I once heard a beautiful Yiddish expression. I'll try and translate it, but just for those that understand a bit of Yiddish, it's beautiful. I was once in a discussion overseas on a family trip. I don't know, some sensitive topic came up and I just was quiet. And someone was looking to me and they were looking for a response, and I was quiet and I was silent. So someone, a family member, said to me in Yiddish, an expression I had, which I've used since, because it's a beautiful expression, he said to me, "Favosh schweigst du azoi hoich? Why are you being quiet so loudly?" But that was meant in a negative sense, but I'm just bringing it because sometimes that's the way it is. That silence of Aaron spoke volumes. It spoke about his acceptance, his conviction, his faith in God. He's ready to surrender to God. He's ready, his resilience and his conviction to rebuild and to reconnect. It wasn't a time for words, but it was a silence that transmitted something deeper than words. And that's, as I say, that's something we can learn from, because it's something we can all use in our own development, in our own leadership positions, in our own circle of influence, to learn the language of silence and to learn how to transmit something within ourselves and to others in a way which is beyond words. I'm just going to end off by reading the last part of that chapter, because I've actually seen a little clip of this, which it describes. It says in 2010, which is not a long time ago, relatively speaking, Elie Wiesel performed an entire concert of songs from his childhood. In New York, he said, the author writes, "I sat in the third row with my daughter." He began by saying, and it's actually on video, you can YouTube it. He said, "I hope you don't expect some kind of late life career change. This is only once." And he sang old songs from his youth. He sang Rozhinkis mit Mandlin. These are old Yiddish songs that parents would sing to children, from Pripachak and so on, from Cheder and so on and so forth. And he said, when we would sing these songs when we were children, he says, the poor did not feel their poverty, the sick didn't feel their sickness. And he sang a whole bunch of songs. He says, after an hour and a half of this concert, Elie Wiesel told the following story. He said, "In 1943, my mother took me to spend Shabbat with the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, and the Rebbe's nephew was there. The nephew had recently escaped from Poland, from Galicia, and everyone there begged him to tell of what he saw. The Rebbe's nephew replied, not in words, but by singing a song." What was the song he sang? The famous song that was sung in the ghettos, the song that was sung in the concentration camps, the song of Ani Ma'amin, I believe, a song of faith about the coming of Mashiach. It contains the words, Afal pi sheyitma mea, although he's late and he's delayed, Mashiach is long overdue, but I still wait for him, expecting him every day. And there's actually a little video of this. I should have actually got it for you today, but you can check it out yourself. Elie Wiesel actually sings animamin. He closes his eyes. And although we spoke about this a few weeks ago, Elie Wiesel himself struggled in his words. He struggled back and forth from different areas of faith. Understandably so. Completely understood. But then when he sang the song of animamin, you could see himself transporting himself to a world beyond words, to a world beyond questions, to a world so deep that just brings out the depth of the soul of the person, the emunah, the faith, the conviction, the resilience, and the inner strength of every human being. And Elie Wiesel sings that song of animamin, and he finishes it, and he lingers a bit, and then he walks off the stage and he ends the concert. And that's the power of the language of silence. So on that note, we're gonna end the words, but hopefully we try to bring out the concept as best we can. And I think, again, the takeaway for us is the ability for all of us in our own way to sometimes learn and use the language of silence, learn that nigun language, the language just beyond words, to bring out that which cannot be or to go to. That's where we cannot go to through the power of words. So as I said before, just to remind everyone, next week we're going to finish this series. In two weeks' time, we're going to have a mini series. And also in 2 weeks' time, we're going to draw the raffle. So I wish everyone a great day. And hopefully see you next week.
Thank you.
All the best, everyone.
Thank you.